And now we are excited to talk about current policy issues in Above the Fold with WRGW, with two co-hosts from the GW Wongcast, a podcast about public policy produced by graduate students from GW's Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. Here with us in the studio, we have students Eric Ledoux and Adam Brooks, as well as WRGW News anchors Matt Williams and Harris Kay. Welcome, folks.
Good to be here.
Yeah, good to be here.
Eric is a first-year MPP student with a concentration in program evaluation, and Adam is a second-year MPP candidate focusing on defense policy. Tonight, we will be discussing changes to the nuclear defense strategies. So I'm going to pass it off to Adam to introduce us. What were we talking about, nukes? What's going on right now?
So basically, every year, the Department of Defense releases something called the Nuclear Posture Review. It talks about what the U.S. nuclear strategy is. The purpose of the document is to, it's basically deterrence. It tells our adversaries what our strategy is and how we'll respond to an attack. It lays out the parameters for what we consider to be an attack worthy of responding with nuclear weapons. And basically, it's a warning, right? And this year's Nuclear Posture Review is significant because it makes several significant changes.
What are they switching up?
The first change is that it explicitly rejects the sole purpose doctrine. Sole purpose doctrine is basically nuclear weapons are only going to be used in response to a nuclear attack, right? So it rejects that doctrine in favor of something called an extreme circumstances doctrine, where if there's a non-nuclear attack that damages U.S. infrastructure or U.S. populations and it's extreme enough, we'll respond with nuclear force. And they don't explicitly state that it could be a cyber attack or a space-based attack, but that's what people are theorizing that it means, because cyber warfare has become more of a threat to the United States. The Defense Department actually talks about cyber being a separate domain. They compare it to, so there's land, sea, air, and now there's space and cyber, where our adversaries, i.e. China and Russia, are developing, you know, advanced capabilities, capabilities that could significantly threaten the U.S. economy. Like, let's say, for example, they launch a cyber attack on Wall Street and erase all of our financial records. It could cause serious economic harm in the United States. Or let's say they hack into the power grid and shut down all the power on the East Coast. That could constitute extreme circumstances where we would respond with a nuclear attack. So basically what that's doing is the DOD is now using nuclear weapons, nuclear deterrence, to deter not only a nuclear attack or a significant conventional attack, but also a cyber attack or a space-based attack on our satellites that could shut down our communication systems. That's very significant. The other thing is they mentioned that they could use nuclear force in the event of nuclear terrorism. It explicitly says if a terrorist uses a nuclear weapon, we will hold not only the terrorist group responsible, but the country that sponsored them.
Wow.
Or harbored them responsible. And we could respond with a nuclear attack. So let's say, for example, Pakistan sold nuclear technology to a terrorist group. That could mean the United States might respond with nuclear weapons, and that's also meant to deter selling nuclear technology to terrorists. And the other thing is the other significant change is that now we're advocating low yield nuclear weapons. We're advocating adding them to the arsenal because in response to Russia, actually, Russia has started obtaining low yield nuclear weapons, and Russia has started talking about how they could use these low-yield weapons to escalate, to de-escalate, essentially. And what that means is, in the event of a conventional war between Russia and NATO, Russia has, you know, they have their conventional strategic nuclear weapons, right? And they also have these tactical nuclear weapons. So if you're losing a conventional war, they could drop a low-yield nuclear device on a European city. And then the only option left to, say, the United States and its European allies are, we can escalate to a full-scale strategic nuclear war, or we can surrender, essentially. And so adding these low-yield weapons to the arsenal gives us a third option, which is, oh, Moscow nuked nuked Warsaw. We're going to nuke St. Petersburg with a low-yield device. It gives us more options, and it deters that escalate-to-de-escalate strategy. And the idea is, if we don't have these weapons, Russia will be more willing to use the low-yield weapons. So, essentially, we're building these nuclear weapons to prevent a nuclear exchange.
So, is...
We want smaller nuclear weapons so that other people won't use smaller nuclear weapons against us.
Yes, yes. And it makes sense if you think about it from a deterrence perspective. If Russia sees the vulnerability, if they're losing a conventional war and they think they can escalate to de-escalate, drop a low-yield nuclear device and not face any nuclear consequences, then they're going to do it. They're going to be more likely to do it. But if they think, oh, if I nuke the U.S. military marching through Belarus right now, they're going to take out, you know, they're going to drop one on St. Petersburg. They're not going to do it. You know, they're going to be less likely to do it.
Can you exactly, like, other numbers, or how do you explain what exactly separates a lower yield tactical nuclear weapon from a more conventional one? Like, just size of the blast radius?
Well, you just said it right there. It's meant to be used tactically. It is smaller, lower yield. When we talk about nukes, we sort of talk about megatons, right? Mm-hmm. And to give you some perspective, a 1 megaton nuclear weapon would completely destroy the Washington, D.C. and the northern Virginia suburbs and suburbs around Maryland. But there would be survivors, right? And so, like, you would use a low-yield nuclear weapon to, for example, deny an area to enemy forces, right? Like, you might nuke Pusan, for example, in South Korea so that U.S. forces can't... so that they can't depart, they can't arrive at Pusan and unload equipment and stuff, right? Or in Europe, you might use it on a U.S. military base so that they can't use that to supply the troops. But a strategic nuclear weapon, you use that when you want to completely obliterate a country, right? Strategic nuclear weapons are meant to deter a strategic nuclear attack, not a tactical nuclear attack, right? And so we're adding that to our arsenal to deter that tactical nuclear attack. It's a vulnerability that the DOD has recognized.
But surely we don't need to be concerned about this. We haven't seen a nuclear weapon used in war since World War II. Like, why is this news now? Like, we've been living in a world with nuclear weapons for so long, and they've never been... Has something happened that's, like, causing them to relook at their strategic stance on using weapons like that?
It's Russia. Russia has been very... forward about why it's obtaining these low yield weapons. Russia has adopted this doctrine. It's called escalate to de-escalate. They have said this is what we plan to do. Essentially, they've telegraphed that. Just like the United States, Russia will talk about what its nuclear strategy is to deter us. Like, we release this posture review to deter them. They tell us what their nuclear strategy is to deter us, and they're getting low-yield weapons, and so now we're doing it, too, to deter that strategy, essentially.
What's interesting in the nuclear posture review on the defense.gov website, they have it – it's in English first, and then the first link is in translation into Russian, and then Chinese, Korean, Japanese, and French, which is – I thought was interesting that Russian was the first top translation, and it's pretty prominent, like, on the page, so – yeah, they're clearly trying to send a message to them.
To everyone that has nukes and can shoot nukes at us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the other thing you have to really keep in mind is a credible nuclear deterrent, a credible U.S. nuclear deterrent, it promotes nonproliferation. I know it sounds kind of weird, and it sounds the logic sounds kind of convoluted, but the theory is, and this has worked in practice, if the U.S. has a credible nuclear deterrent and it extends that deterrent to its allies, and even, you know, some non-allies, those countries are less likely to acquire their own nuclear weapons because they know they'll be protected by the United States. And you take Europe, for example, if they don't believe that the United States has a credible deterrent to a low-yield Russian nuclear device, if they don't believe that the United States will trade Washington for Warsaw, then when the Russians put pressure on NATO, the Europeans are going to capitulate, right? They're not going to be there with the United States if they don't think the United States is going to be capable of protecting them.
So the United States acts as, in a way, the United States' role is as kind of like the nuclear police of the world, is what I'm getting. Is that an that sounds like probably not the best way to word it, but or maybe sort of like we're taking on this role of like protector of our allies, and then that means that our allies don't need to build up this kind of nuclear infrastructure themselves.
That's exactly what it means. Yeah, I mean it's not just in Europe; it's also in East Asia. The nuclear arsenal is meant to keep East Asia, Europe, and primarily East Asia and Europe stable.
So when we were having like book club outside talking about like old books that are about nuclear war, but I'm not going to talk about that now. But we were talking about how some places have a triad, and there's like a value to having a constantly moving nuclear arsenal. I think, Eric, were you talking about that?
Yeah, what I was talking about was how there's this. How I had heard that there's this discussion going on that we have too many nukes that are on the ground in silos in stationary areas, and the problem with a stationary nuclear silo is that it can be targeted. You can't move it, and it means that when you get attacked, if you're getting hit by, if you know you're getting attacked, if missiles are being launched at the United States, it forces the president to have to act quicker in making that decision about whether or not we're going to hit back with nuclear weapons, because you know those missiles might be coming to hit all of the areas that we are currently storing our nuclear weapons, and so we better use them or lose them. And that there's a discussion going on that, you know, it might buy the president more time and allow a more thought out nuclear response if we had all of our nukes on airplanes or submarines, moving nuclear silos, moving launching points, so that it's impossible for someone to just target all of them and take them all out at once.
Well, see, what you just said is an argument in favor of the triad, actually. The land-based, the ICBMs, the Minutemen, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, their primary purpose is to soak up enemy missiles, basically. They are the main target. And you have, in addition to those, the submarine-launched ballistic missiles, which are fired from submarines that are always operating. I believe there's 14 Ohio-class submarines with missiles at sea at all times. And then there's the air-launched missiles and which are basically cruise missiles, and then you have the gravity bombs that are also fired from aircraft. You have all these things so that the enemy can't develop a countermeasure against one or more legs of the triad, because there will always be a third leg of the triad. It's, let's say, for example, you load all your nuclear weapons on aircraft. The enemy can focus all their countermeasures on countering your aircraft, and that reduces your credibility. That reduces the credibility of your deterrent. Or let's take submarines, for example. Let's say you put all your missiles on submarines, and the enemy can focus on developing countermeasures for those submarines. But if you have three different ways of launching your nukes, it's very hard for the enemy to counter them.
So do you guys think that the fact that we've amassed so many nuclear weapons and that we're in a post-nuclear world, like we've used nuclear weapons twice against the Japanese, the U.S. have. Has the world become a safer place as a result of that, or do you think it's become a more dangerous place?
Well first, I just want to...
Oh, yeah.
I want to correct that, because the U.S. has actually reduced its nuclear arsenal by 85% since the end of the Cold War.
Okay.
Right. And
we're no longer in a game of who's got more nukes. And also, a quick thing, you said post-nuclear war.
I feel like
we're not post-nuclear. We are continuing to live in a nuclear world. We've just become more cognizant of it recently.
Right, absolutely. And, like I said, we reduce our arsenal by 85%. We have a bunch of treaties in place to reduce the number of nuclear arms. Like we had the START treaty with Russia, although they haven't been following that, and we've filed complaints about that, and we've made it very clear we want to continue negotiations and negotiate a new START treaty. Russians have not been so cooperative with that. But the main thing here is not the number of nuclear weapons; it's the capability, right? It's the capability of our nuclear arsenal. That's why this posture focuses a lot on developing capabilities, like developing those low-yield nuclear weapons, developing new submarine-launched ballistic missiles. And it doesn't focus on let's increase the number of weapons. It focuses on let's replace old infrastructure. Let's replace old weapons that are wearing out. Because a lot of people don't realize this, but there's sort of... I'll break it down into basically three periods, right? So there's the initial build-up in the 60s. We built our initial infrastructure. We built our ICBMs. We built our... we built our strategic bombers. We built that infrastructure, and then we sort of revitalized our infrastructure in the 80s with Reagan, and we haven't really updated our infrastructure since then. Over half of the nuclear infrastructure that we have, it was made back in the 80s. It's over 40 years old, and over a quarter of the nuclear infrastructure we have dates back to the Manhattan Project. So our infrastructure is very old. Our nuclear infrastructure is very old, and because it's so old. Because our command and control systems and communication systems for our nuclear arsenal is so old, it reduces the credibility of our nuclear deterrent, and it makes nuclear war more likely.
I wouldn't say old. I would call it vintage.
Yes. That's one way to put it. And I mean, the other thing you have to put into perspective is that back in the day, in the 80s, when we modernized our nuclear arsenal, 10.6% of the DoD's budget was spent on revitalizing that arsenal. In the 60s, it was 17.1%. This posture review is estimating that modernizing our nuclear force will only cost 3.7% of the DoD's budget to do that, right? And to put that into a bigger perspective, that's only basically it's 1% of our national budget. It's not that much money. It's affordable to do it, and it's necessary to do it. I would say it's necessary because, you know, I don't want to die.
Agreed.
That's just me, right?
So let me rephrase the question then, because I think I botched that. But what I was trying to get at was, do you think a world that where certain countries have nuclear weapons, like the world we live in today, do you think that's a safer world than if nobody had nuclear weapons? I guess that's the question I'm trying to get at.
Well, along with our book club, before the show, I was discussing this possibility of, well, the thing about nuclear weapons is that it takes time, energy, and a lot of resources. Not every government has the capacity to make these sorts of things. But in a world without nuclear weapons, the other deterrent, the other weapon of mass destruction becomes chemical weapons. And, I mean, you know, Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons. We've got Bashar al-Assad's got chemical weapons. At least I'm pretty sure he didn't get rid of all of them the last time we asked him to give them up. So in a way, you could say maybe we are safer with nuclear weapons, because it's something that we can shoot on a rocket and hit someone from really far away, and it's immediate damage, and it immediately knocks out dangerous facilities or military stations that could do harm to us later, including places where chemical weapons are made. So it might actually be that nuclear weapons are the reason why there isn't more weight towards other governments that would use chemical weapons, which are cheap and easy to make compared to nuclear weapons.
I would say that nuclear weapons can make the world safer, but not by themselves. I think the reason why we haven't seen any great power wars since World War II is that the United States is so overwhelmingly powerful and has such global reach that it doesn't make any sense for like our adversaries like Russia or China to sort of invade Europe or invade Japan or fight a big conventional war, because the costs are too high. We've made the cost too high. And it's not just our nuclear arsenal. Nuclear arsenal is only one piece of deterrence. You also have to have a credible conventional deterrence, right? Like, a good example of this is, again, Europe, right? You can have a great nuclear umbrella, right? But you're not going to convince your allies that you're going to be willing to, you know, launch strategic nuclear weapons at Russia if they invade Europe, unless you have boots on the ground, you know, unless you have a tripwire, like in Korea, for example. You have, I believe it's 30,000 U.S. soldiers on the 38th parallel. And if North Korea ever invaded South Korea, you know South Korea knows the United States would defend it because its troops are in harm's way, right? But if we just pledged to protect them with nuclear weapons, that wouldn't be a credible deterrent. So I guess the short answer to your question is the world is safer because of nuclear weapons, but it's only safer because those nuclear weapons are part of a larger deterrent strategy that the United States has to maintain global stability.
And don't forget our most powerful deterrent strategy, diplomacy.
Yeah, absolutely. Diplomacy is very important. I mean, it's like the defense secretary said, if you don't fund the State Department, I got to buy more bullets.
I didn't know he said that. Wow. That's a good poll quote. Another question I wanted to go back to was you said the our current strategy is the doctrine of extreme – what was it? Extreme
– It's extreme circumstances. I don't know if it's called a doctrine. That's just what I'm calling it.
Oh, yeah. So, but is this the first time that the United States has taken this approach to nuclear weapons, or is this like completely new?
So what the U.S. has is so there's something called a first use policy and a no first use policy, and it's pretty intuitive, right? If you have a first use policy, you reserve the right to use nuclear weapons first. You have a no first use policy, you're saying we will not use nuclear weapons first, we will only use them if we're attacked with a nuclear weapon, right? And so the extreme circumstances has sort of been implicit in a lot of ways. Like if Russia invaded continental United States and we were losing, we would probably use nuclear weapons, just between you and me and everybody listening.
it's good speculation.
Right. But we weren't explicit about that. The extreme circumstances that they talk about in the posture review makes that explicit. And the reason why they're doing that is, again, because our adversaries are developing increasingly sophisticated cyber warfare capabilities, and it's a vulnerability, right? And we've decided we're going to deter it with not just our own cyber capabilities, but also our nuclear weapons, if necessary, if the attack is significant enough. And do not underestimate just how destructive, you know, a cyber attack can be. You can shut down the entire power grid on the eastern coast, and that would cause billions of dollars in economic damage. It would cost thousands of lives. It would cause serious damage.
It would destroy the infrastructure. One of our favorite topics on Above the Fold is infrastructure.
I guess the issue I have with the idea of combating or, you know, deterring smaller nukes with other smaller nukes is it feels like it fills in this gray zone between we're using nukes or we're not. And I mean, I would make the assumption that maybe a policy that might just deter you. I feel like any use of any nuke, no matter how big or small it is, the fact is that you're still leaving your it's worse than salting the earth. You're like creating a spot where like no one can ever go for what, thousands of years. And I mean, ethically speaking, I think I'd rather just tell people, like, if you're going to try to use any kind of nuclear material in war, then we'll just deter that by saying, well, we'll nuke your capital. Now, I know that sounds crazy, but also it makes me concerned. I think it's also a little crazy to think that, like, okay, a small nuke versus a small nuke, if we get to that point, it sounds like that it's just going to be an escalation policy.
Well, let me give you a scenario, right? So Russia invades Lithuania, the Baltic states, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're part of NATO, and so we're obligated to defend them. And so the United States and NATO go to war with Russia, and there's a conventional war, right? We send our troops there, we start beating the Russians, we start pushing them back, and then the Russians launch a low-yield nuclear weapon on advancing U.S. forces. And they say, surrender on our terms, or we'll launch more of these, and we're going to launch the next one at Washington, D.C., or we're going to launch the next one at Berlin, right? And your only option is we can surrender, or we can launch our strategic nuclear weapons at Moscow, which will trigger a larger nuclear escalation, right? And so you have nuclear Armageddon. It's either nuclear Armageddon or capitulation. Now, if you have your own low-yield nuclear weapons, you have a third option, right? You can say, oh, you just dropped a nuclear weapon on our forces. We're going to drop a nuclear weapon on yours. Now you don't have to capitulate. You just match their level of escalation.
Well, on that note, we'll... Assuming everything goes well, we'll be back next week. But Eric, did you want to throw in something real quick at the end?
So,
correction section?
Yeah, correction section, everyone. The last time I was in here a couple weeks ago, I had we were talking about what had been, at the time, the leaked infrastructure plan for the plan for the Trump administration. And I had said, oh, yeah, they want $200 million. They're going to pay $200 million in order to stimulate $1.5 trillion in infrastructure spending. It turns out I was misquoting that because it was actually $200 billion. So it's still a gap between that and $1.5 trillion, but it's not so chimerical as a $200 million trying to make it up to even $1 trillion.
It's a big difference.
Huge.
Between the B and the T, it's a lot. But anyway, thank you. And thank you all for listening. The GW Wonkcast airs new episodes every Wednesday where they discuss a range of policy issues and all things wonky. You can follow and subscribe to the GW Wonkcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, or check out their Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages. The handle is at GW Wonkcast. Their content is fire. Thank you once again to Eric and Adam for coming in, and to Harris and Matt for being here too. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next Friday on WRGW.